when I took my first job in 1979 at Wayne State, the dean said to the students, look to your left, look to your right. One of you won't be here in 4 years. In 2019 or 2020, the dean of our medical school said, look to your left, look to your right. These are your brothers and sisters who are going to help you get through this difficult training.
That's Dr. Richard Frankel, professor of medicine and geriatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine. And this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacobellis, talking with innovators and experts about health and healthcare in America. Dr. Frankel is trained as a qualitative researcher whose interests include face-to-face communication and the role of technology and its effects on quality, safety, and outcomes of care. In addition to his research interests, he has been a medical educator for the past 40 years. He heads the Aspire Fellowship, which stands for Advanced Scholars Program for Internists in Research and Education, and is also a senior scientist at the VA Center for Health Care Information and Communication and the Regenstrief Institute. In addition, he holds an appointment at the Lerner School of Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Frankel is a founding fellow of the Academy for Communication and Healthcare. To date, he has published more than 275 scientific papers. He's internationally respected for his contributions and achievements in fostering humanism in medical education, practice, and research. Rich Frankel, welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Teresa. I'm delighted to be here.
So your work centers around provider-patient communication. What led to your interest in this field?
Well, I would say that I was the recipient of a very unfortunate experience very early in my career. My mom, who was 70 years old at the time, had some symptoms that she couldn't explain and was hospitalized for 11 days. And her family physician, who was an emigre from Nazi Germany and certainly knew about suffering, wasn't really trained in psychosocial aspects of care. And just prior to being discharged from the hospital, he told her that there was nothing wrong with her, that all the tests came back negative, and that she should go home and just deal with her problems. And so she did go home, and about 3 hours after being discharged from the hospital, took her own life. And it was clear that this was what I've come to call an iatrogenic suicide. That is to say that the way in which her physician dismissed her symptoms and didn't take them as being real for her really led to a sense of despair. And she had had two family members who had died of undiagnosed cancers. And I think she was concerned that she had an undiagnosed cancer. Well, that was in November of 1979. And in August of 79, I took my first job at Wayne State University School of Medicine. And I was teaching medical residents about communication skills. And I could see how poorly trained they were in this area, and that they really struggled to figure out how to address patient suffering in a way that was helpful to patients and allowed them to be honest and forthright about how they were in that situation. And that's really where my focus on doctor-patient communication started, and it hasn't wavered one little bit in the 45 years that I've been teaching in medical school settings.
Well, I'm first of all so sorry for that awful experience. It's unimaginable that your mother went through that. And one of my questions that I had intended to ask you a little later on was that, you know, why is this important? And you know, is our clinical skills and communication skills equally important in your mind? And clearly your story illustrates how tragic the outcome can be if there's a clinician that is not able to be compassionate and communicate in that way with their patient.
Yeah, and it's since I tell this story in public, there are a large number of physicians that I've met and talked with who have lost patients to suicide. And we tend to focus on the person who has taken their own life and not the person who was caring for that individual. And we know that physicians suffer disproportionately to the mistakes that they make. And so because this isn't a topic that's talked about very, very frequently, it's sort of the elephant in the room, providing a safe space for physicians to talk about the effects of suicide on them, I think is really important. So the medical interview is to the social sciences what biomedicine is to the natural sciences. And the medical history and the way in which the medical history is co-constructed between the clinician and the patient really is the story of the illness. And that is often diagnostic. We know, for example, that over 50% of all patient outpatient visits, and there are 1 billion+ outpatient visits per year, involve conditions which in the old World Health Organization definition of disease are disease-free. That is to say that they're healthy patients. So if more than half of the patients don't have an identifiable disease, what is it that you're treating? Well, you may be treating a case of subthreshold depression, or you might be treating people who are anxious about COVID and being stuck at home. And so the psychological and social dimensions by themselves are important, but then there are so many different disorders. Hypertension, for example, has a psychosocial component. Diabetes has a psychosocial component. And now we talk about social determinants of health. That is, those things in one's family context or one's environment that contribute to poor health. So I think that it's fair to say that without the medical history and without the interaction between the clinician and the patient, we would be guessing at a lot of what drives behavior. And then on the other side of things, once you've done made a diagnosis, how do you help the person to take the steps that you think will help them most? And that requires really good communication skills and being able to negotiate with the patient about what's best for them, but from their perspective and not from a paternal perspective saying, I know what's best for you. If you go back to the 1960s and 1970s, you look at a show like Dr. Welby or Dr. Kildare, and it was really all men, and it was father knows best. And the prescription for each episode was the patient had some serious disease. The male physician hero diagnoses it, tells the patient what to do. The patient does it. They make a miraculous recovery, and everybody lives happily thereafter. But we also know that somewhere between 40 and 80% of people who are given a medical recommendation don't follow that recommendation. And some part of that probably has to do with poor communication. I think, I don't know what it was like for you growing up and being in school, but I never liked it when people just told me what to do and never gave me an explanation for why I should be doing what I'm being told to do. And I think many people feel the same way. Anti-maskers or anti-vaxxers, if you just tell them you're doing the wrong thing, they don't respond positively to that, nor do many people. So a physician telling the person, this is what you must do, is unlikely actually to produce the result that you're hoping for.
Well, and part of communication is listening, right? Communication is bi-directional. So it's not just being able to talk to the patient in a manner in which they can understand and comprehend, but also understanding what those barriers might be for them to comply with the recommendation.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in the early 20th century to probably the 1970s, this idea of bidirectionality really didn't play a very big role. The patient was a mystery to be solved. And your effect on the patient wasn't really taken into account. And then in the 1970s and 80s, people started using videotape and audio tape to look at how the physician or how the clinician and their behavior was influencing the patient and their behavior. And then going the other direction, how the patient was influencing the physician. So people who study nonverbal behavior, for example, have shown that when a doctor and patient are communicating well, they're in synchrony, their body motion mirrors each other. When they're not in sync, you can see sometimes the patient will have their arms crossed, and they'll be looking away, and there'll be long silences, and all of that is meaningful information. And so, you know, in the same way that we teach medical students to be able to read an EKG, we need to teach medical students to be able to read nonverbal behavior or to recognize the role that they themselves are playing in creating the very behavior that they're critical of.
And I feel that so much of this is or can be tied back to the fact that typically medical students are students who've been high achievers academically and maybe have not focused or had an opportunity to develop those social and soft skills as much as the, you know, the academics, the math, the science. But I would imagine, I mean, over the 45 years that you've been really pioneering this field, that we have made some progress. I was reading a few years ago about medical schools looking to recruit students who perhaps weren't even, you know, science majors. They were looking for people with various backgrounds, people who maybe brought some of those softer skills to bear.
Absolutely. And I can speak, having been on our admissions committee at Indiana University School of Medicine for a decade, that the medical school interview itself has changed. So in 1999, IU adopted a competency curriculum. And one of the major competencies was communication, self-awareness, the role of physician in society. All of these, as you call them, soft skills. And so we actually had to teach the admissions committee officers how to ask good questions of aspiring medical students because they themselves as faculty had never gotten this training. And we went through a half day workshop with them to teach them good skills for getting at this information. And students who didn't perform well in terms of these competencies weren't admitted to the medical school. And so that's a huge change. And I think many, many medical schools now put an emphasis on being well-rounded and not just performing on standardized exams. Mm-hmm. Cleveland Clinic Lerner School of Medicine, for example, has a curriculum that in the first 2 years spends 150 curriculum hours on the medical humanities. Wow. That is huge. And that really provides the context and the space for students to learn not only the technical skills of providing care, but the social and emotional skills that it takes to witness someone suffering, be with that suffering, and help the person in whatever journey they're on, and then also help themselves. Because if all you ever see during the day is sufferer after sufferer after sufferer, and you don't take care of yourself, pretty soon you're going to go down a rabbit hole and only see the negative and not see the positive. So there are a lot of programs now that are investing in resilience training, and that involves using the arts and music to help people deal with the stresses and strains of providing care. This is especially true during the pandemic, when physicians were reassigned to jobs that they had never had before. A close colleague of mine wound up having to staff the emergency room. And he said, you know, I haven't been in an emergency room for 33 years since I was a third year medical student. So, and that's very, very stressful because you're dealing with life and death situations. You're dealing with a lot of anxiety on your own part about getting infected, having a family to go back to, and maybe having to be separate from them while you're providing care.
Sure.
So to answer your question, I think that things have changed, and they've changed for the better.
And I can imagine from the physician's point of view to have this very important and stressful job, as you pointed out, and then to be asked now to also be able to focus on these other skills that are, you know, perhaps secondary to being excellent at making a diagnosis and, you know, determining the appropriate clinical course of care, now being asked to also be a good listener and to be compassionate and to be, you know, present with suffering and to do all of those other things must be just an additional cross to bear, an additional burden for them.
Well, I partially agree with what you're saying, but the way you're framing it makes it sound like it's an add-on to another skill set that's being taught. And in point of fact, what we're talking about is a way of being, which incorporates both skill sets simultaneously and sometimes sequentially. So to say this is over here and we're adding another rock to your backpack is to make it an additional burden rather than to say, this is what being a physician consists of. This is what you dedicate your life to. And the skills on both sides are equally important.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and just being able to also be present in the room, I'm sure adds to the ability to be a diagnostician, right? To hear the whole story and to appreciate the patient as a whole person. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this issue of trust. One of the things that you have written about is how important trust is to the physician-patient relationship. What are some situations that can erode that trust, and what can the outcome of that be?
So there are two parts to my answer. The first part is about physician-patient trust. The second is about physician-to-physician trust. So in terms of physicians and patients, I think creating a safe space for patients to talk about difficult issues without being judgmental and without interrupting is critically important. And we talk a lot nowadays about shared decision-making. What that typically means is shared decision-making at the end of a visit when we're talking about diagnosis and treatment, rather than the very beginning of the visit where the physician says something like, how can I help you? What brings you here? Something of that sort. And the patient starts to say, well, I have shoulder pain. And our very first study of physician interruption showed that after 18 seconds, patients were cut off from sharing more than a single concern. And that does not go very far to creating trust. In fact, what it does is creates a question in the patient's mind of, am I going to actually get to talk about what's most important to me? And we know, especially for older adults, that it's the third thing on their list that's most important from their perspective. And 80% of the time, they never get past the first thing. So that opening of the encounter is the very first place in which you can build trust. And what we have shown is that if you take a little bit of extra time and say, okay, so I hear your shoulder is hurting. That's an important concern. I'll come back to that in just a moment. What else? Well, you know, my knees have been really aching a lot. Okay, that's important also. I'll come back to that. What else? Well, honestly, I've been feeling sort of sad and blue lately and like life isn't worth living. Well, that's an important concern. We'll certainly come back to that. What else? Well, that's it. I don't have anything more to say. So now in the first 30 seconds, you've created a list, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out which is the most important of those three concerns. If on the other hand, you say, well, tell me about your shoulder and when did this start? You're now starting down a pathway that A, is not going to necessarily lead you to a good diagnosis. And B, you can rest assured that once interrupted, patients don't return to say, I'm feeling sad and blue. If they do raise it, they raise it at the very, very end of the visit where they'll say, oh, by the way, doc, I've been feeling sad and blue lately and like life isn't worth living. That's a terrible place to have somebody raise such an important concern because it's going to take you a good 10 minutes to figure out what's going on. And now your next patient is going to be anxious about the fact that you're 10 minutes late. You've gone over your allotted time by 10 minutes. So something as simple as the opening of the encounter is one place where you can build trust. I think the other place is, as I said, being non-judgmental and being a good listener, just giving people time to tell their story. And another one of the innovations that's occurred over the past two decades or so is this idea that a patient has a story to tell. And that if you're a good listener, and I see you doing it on my video screen, as I'm talking, you're shaking your head up and down saying, I understand, go ahead, go ahead. So that's another thing that encourages patients to tell their story, is just being silent, using what we call continuers. Uh-huh, I see, go on, something like that, which allows the patient the space to fully tell the story. And that's a real trust builder. Having the opportunity not to feel rushed, not to feel interrupted, but to have the spaciousness to tell the story. And there's good research that's been done that compares a strictly biomedical machine gun questions to a more what we might call psychosocial or biopsychosocial or relationship-centered care model. The average difference that it takes to create that trusting environment and that safe space for a patient is 1 minute longer than the, you know, sort of transactional, give me the information, I'll give you the answer, you'll be on your way. So we know that the time cost is really quite minimal. And there's also a lot of research that's based on outcomes of care that show that the outcomes of care in that second model, the relationship-centered model, are much, much better than where patients are being machine-gunned by the questions that are being asked. So that's just a couple of ways. A third way is at the end of an encounter, to do what we call a teach-back or a talk-back. To say to the patient, now we've gone through a lot of things. Would it be okay with you if I ask you to just repeat what you heard me say so that we know that we're both on the same page and we know that you've heard and understood the recommendations that I've made? Patients don't find that a problem. They like it. And that too has been shown to increase trust and improve outcomes. Now, I said there were two parts to this answer, and the second part is actually about physician-to-physician trust. There's a huge literature on physician-patient trust, physician-nurse trust, physician-administrator trust. There's virtually nothing in the literature on how much physicians trust one another. And in an era of electronic medical records, and where documentation is now so regimented, doctors' trust of one another is sometimes really challenging. And part of that goes back to the way in which medical school culture trains physicians. So if you're a pediatrician, for example, and I'm a super subspecialist cardiothoracic surgeon, somewhere in there is going to come a point at which I think to myself as the surgeon, well, the best you could do was to become a pediatrician, a general pediatrician, whereas I've had extra training. I make five times what you make. So should I trust your judgment? And then coming the other way as a general pediatrician, can I trust the judgment of this person who's going to take 3 seconds to look at what the question that I'm asking and may be humiliating toward me in their answer, saying, essentially, you should have thought of this on your own. Why are you coming to me to ask me this kind of silly question? So we know that face-to-face interactions is one way of building trust among physicians. Many physicians now have never met one another face-to-face. They communicate entirely through the electronic medical record. And there again, the electronic medical record is a representation of what happened in the exam room. But there's also a lot of evidence to suggest that records are inaccurate, incomplete, and physicians know that. We had a physician who said, I don't even trust my own medical records. Why should I trust somebody else's medical records? And another, this was in a study that we did, another physician who said, I always used to learn something from my own records when they were handwritten or typed. And now it's just make work. I'm just filling in the boxes and it's not really educational for me. A third physician said, I spend 2 hours a night on my electronic medical records, but I'm listening to podcasts, not as highbrow as prescriptive communications, but he said, I'm listening to my favorite comedian.
Ooh.
So would you want your and trust your physician if you knew that she or he was spending their time filling out your medical record listening to their favorite comedian? Probably not. So this is a real area where there's opportunity for growth, and that growth should begin in medical school with respect. And you know, at the end of the day, every graduate from medical school is called doctor. And that's a basis for professional relationships and positive professional relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that answers your question.
Very much so. Thank you. What I really wanted to talk about today, and this has all been so interesting that I haven't gotten to, really what led me to you is I read an article where you were interviewed about the issue of physicians apologizing.
Yeah.
And that seems like such a revolutionary, frankly, position to take, because, well, apologizing is hard for anybody who's made a mistake, but physicians seem to have more difficulty with it than many others. And, you know, sometimes there are legal reasons why they are dissuaded or not encouraged to offer an apology. So what is your perspective on that?
Well, I'm really glad that you asked that question. And to put this in a broader perspective, we know that apologies can be healing. So if you think about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, that was an opportunity to create a safe space in which two parties who had been at war with one another and killing one another were able to take responsibility and apologize for what happened. And the results we know were very positive. This is what's now kind of known as a non-apology apology. If your feelings were hurt, I'm sorry. That's a non-apology apology. So we got interested in how many apologies were made, by whom, and under what circumstances. And we have a database of about 8,000 third year medical students' stories, some of which contained stories about apologies. And the headlines are that almost all of the apologies were offered by senior physicians or senior residents, which is what you would expect. A third year medical student is basically observing rather than. And most of those apologies were incomplete. Apology, a genuine apology, has four components to it. One is acknowledging that an apology is necessary and taking responsibility for what happened. The second is providing an explanation, a non-defensive explanation. The third is showing humility or being sorry for what happened. And the fourth is some kind of recompense, whether it's psychological or monetary. Now, in the malpractice world, apology has been a big deal. And there are 27 states now that shield physicians from being prosecuted for making an apology and taking responsibility for what happened. So we do know, and there's good evidence to show, that apologies, when grievous harm has occurred, have a positive effect. They lower the rates of medical malpractice suits. What we were interested in was much less grievous in terms of, you know, somebody showing up 20 minutes late for a visit, or forgetting the patient's name, or forgetting a part of their history, or saying something that was offensive. So these are much lesser kinds mm-hmm. of things. So what we found was that only 17% of all the apologies that were made were full apologies, genuine apologies. That means that 83% of the apologies were of the non-apology apology type. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important, number one, because it leaves patients feeling untrusted. It leaves them feeling uncared for. Number two is something called the hidden or informal curriculum of medical education. And this is the idea that medical students learn as much by what they observe outside of the classroom as they do in the classroom. So if they're on a particular service, let's say they're on an internal medicine service, and the attending physician is sort of Attila the Hun-like, they're going to adopt that behavior that they see the other person engaging in. So if 83% of the time, the people that you're observing are doing inadequate apologies, then you yourself are likely to pick up that behavior. Now, we also found that when there was a genuine apology, the students rated that apology and rated the experience very highly. So they value it when they see it, but they don't see it very often. So this leads to the question of, can physicians learn to apologize, genuinely apologize? And the answer is obviously yes, but it takes some skill. If what you come into the training with is the experience that I had in apology, then you've got a long way to go to figure out how to make it a genuine apology. And I think, although many people won't have had such a dramatic experience as the one that I had, we sort of automatically say things like, well, if your feelings were hurt, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, I know that what I did was inappropriate, and I sincerely, you know, I was trying to be helpful, but I sincerely regret what I did, and I will make every effort. In fact, I read about a seminar on apology, and I'll make every effort to try to correct my behavior and do it differently next time. So, like every other skill, like listening to the heart, communication skills can be taught, learned, and put into practice.
Well, I want to apologize because I have gone way over the time that I promised you that I would keep you on this call. But this is so interesting to me, and that's my explanation that I would like to ask your permission to ask you one last question before I let you go. What you just described, and you alluded to the fact that a genuine apology can actually reduce the rate of malpractice lawsuits, but you also have written that apologies have an impact on physician resilience. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Certainly. So until recently, the beginning of the decade, it was illegal for physicians in Illinois to talk about a malpractice case with a spouse, friends, colleagues, and so forth. So we know, and I think I might have said earlier, that physicians suffer disproportionately to the mistakes that they make. And so we do know that physicians who have been sued, whether they win or lose the malpractice case, have the same reaction. And there's a what's known as an anger cluster. Some physicians get really angry at having been sued, and some physicians get really depressed. So the opportunity to talk about and discuss with your colleagues what happened, to get some coaching on how to make a genuine apology. And then to do that apology is like taking aspirin for a headache. It gives you the opportunity to let those feelings that you're having out and to heal from whatever mistake you've made. You can't change the past, but you certainly can change your behavior as you move forward into the future. And so I think being in community, again, medicine and doctoring was an individual sport, and now it's clearly a team sport, not only among physicians, but among nurses and physical therapists and occupational therapists, social workers. And we've moved from the science of individuals to team science. So we know that when people work together in community, when they work together as a group, they perform better than they do as individuals. That's a shift in thinking, and it's a shift in the way in which medicine is taught. When I took my first job in 1979 at Wayne State, the dean said to the students, look to your left, look to your right. One of you won't be here in 4 years. In 2019 or 2020, the dean of our medical school said, look to your left, look to your right. These are your brothers and sisters who are going to help you get through this difficult training. And they are people you're going to come to rely on and trust to help you. So that's a huge, huge change. I remember going into the medical library at Wayne State. This was before Xeroxing. And there were medical students who would take a single-edged razor blade and they would cut out the articles from the journals that had been assigned to them. So only they would have access to the article, and it would disadvantage all the other students. Well, that kind of competitiveness, that kind of one-upsmanship, it still exists, but it's in a different key, and it's being done in community now.
Well, that is quite a shift, and that yes. fills me with optimism for the future of the medical profession, frankly. And I want to thank you again so much for taking the time to talk with us here on Healthcare Confidential, Dr. Rich Frankel. Where can our listeners learn more?
You can look at the Academy for Communication and Healthcare. I think it's achonline.org. And that's an organization that does training in communication skills. There are a number of journals that have articles that are both patient and physician based. So the Journal of Patient Experience is one of those journals. Journal of General Internal Medicine has a number of articles. Permanente Journal has a number of articles. So there are lots of resources out there. And if anyone has questions and they want to get in touch with me directly, my email is rfrankel@iu.edu, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions that you have.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And we'll put that information in the show notes. And I want to remind listeners that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available every Monday morning wherever you access podcasts. The show is brought to you by Prescriptive Studios and is hosted on Omni Studio. Our theme song is an original composition written and performed by Patrick McCarsick, and our production assistant is John Roy. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback, and help us continue the conversation by dropping a note on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Thank you again, and be well, everyone.